So don't hesitate to ask questions. This is a great opportunity. Natalia's going to talk for probably about an hour-ish, and then maybe we'll have a half hour-ish or so for questions and so on. So please feel free to really take advantage of this opportunity. Here's somebody who knows a whole lot about particle physics, about the LHC, about Higgs boson, all that kind of stuff. You know, ask her questions. So let's give Natalia a warm ISSYP welcome.
Well, thanks, all of you. And let me just add, if you guys have questions that you know that you can't bear to hold until the end, or you're just totally confused because I'm saying something that doesn't make any sense, please interrupt me. We can talk more at the end. So this is a picture. I'm guessing you've all seen pictures like this before of a particle collision at the Large Hadron Collider. What you see here are actually basically the images. You can think of these detectors as being like big digital cameras. Very specialized digital cameras that take pictures of all of the individual particles being produced in a collision. And so this is what you see here. I want to unwrap this picture for you, connect it to the news that I think most of you have probably heard about the Higgs particle. What's that all about? How did the search work? And why do we care about this particle so much? Why tears and applause? Backing up, though, I think there's an even, can everyone hear me okay, by the way? All right, great. Even bigger question, you know, a lot of times you read books about particle physics or you read stories about it. We found a new particle. It's like, why do these people care so much? Why are they so obsessed with particles? So I want to start with that, a view of the world and why learning about new particles is such a big deal. And then talk a little bit more about how we've learned about them from really over the last couple of centuries, how we've learned about them from the first discovery of the electron. A lot of the techniques are the same now that they were then. And finally, looking inside the Higgs discovery, explaining that physics of both the search and what it means a little bit more carefully. And finally, I'll just take a quick look at physics beyond the Higgs and try to explain why nobody's set up, you know, shut up the shop yet now that we've found the Higgs. What else there is to do? Because there is a whole lot more to do, and that's just the beginning. So, why are people obsessed with particles? Well, it's really because if you try to describe all the phenomena in the world, all the phenomena that are on your t-shirts, all of these can be well described in a quantum theory of interacting particles. That's it. You don't need anything else, just interacting particles. Now, that sounds like a bit of a caveat, right? We don't always know which particular particles are doing something. We just know that that every effect we've seen in nature, dark matter, gravity, electromagnetism, all this building blocks of stuff can all be described by particles. And we don't know why those particular particles. We're hoping to try to learn more about why. But we have theories that work, in some cases more than one. And these are all framed as theories of particles. So there used to be, of course, the periodic table. Periodic table of chemistry was a big achievement. We understood patterns in it that helped fill in missing building blocks. And from there, by in the late 1800s, early 1900s, people realized that actually all of these elements were built out of three simpler elements, much, much smaller periodic table, electron, proton, and neutron inside the atoms. And then that sort of blew up again to a bigger periodic table with more stuff that actually isn't part of atoms, but is still a really important part of the structure of nature, helped us to understand it. So in that sense, the Standard Model is a new periodic table. We've got the electrons, up and down quarks. These are building blocks of protons and neutrons. So these guys make up atoms. Neutrinos, I guess you saw quite a bit about them when you all went to Snow Lab. The forces, and then these more unfamiliar particles, people went out and found them. As well as we know there's some kind of dark matter that's probably built out of some other kinds of particles that we don't have much clue what it is. The Higgs particle, which we'll get to, But there's a lot more to this than just a periodic table. So that was, I think, the first natural way of looking at it. But the structure in this picture is actually a whole lot deeper. You see a sense of that just from the fact that there's matter, and then there's this mirror image of antimatter. Every one of these particles has an antiparticle. There's a prediction of some particles from others and of an underlying pattern here, very unlike what you got at the level of the periodic table. And then there are these guys, the particles associated with forces. And that's kind of a weird notion, right? I mean, gravity is a force that pulls us together. You don't see particles in that. Okay, so that's a puzzle. I'd like to try to explain it. It has to go back to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, that whenever you've got any kind of system, a particle, a cat, whatever, really there's some uncertainty in its momentum. It's never in a state of definite momentum. It's never in a state of definite position. Both of them have some uncertainty. You can never know both to infinite precision at the same time, because the product of those uncertainties has to be bigger than this constant, h bar, Planck's constant. The same for the energy and time at which an event, the energy of a particle and the time at which an event occurs. So what this means is they don't follow a single well-defined path. They're sort of wiggling, they have wave functions spread out all over the place. When we talk about a quantum particle, that has to be part of the description. And we never know exactly where they are, where they're going. Another consequence of this is that if they can interact with some other particle, let's say I give the electron an interaction with a photon in my theory. So the electron can radiate. It can radiate light. In a quantum theory where the electron can radiate light, you can never be sure whether it's radiated light or not. So really, we have to think about the state of this electron as having a quantum superposition of just an electron or an electron accompanied by some light that it just emitted. And a good rule for understanding this, related to the uncertainty principle, is that the electron can even borrow some energy, right? Energy is uncertain, so it can borrow some energy from what I like to call the quantum bank, produce a photon, and that's fine. The only restriction on that is it has to give back the energy, reabsorb that photon, in a time that's set by this Planck's constant divided by the energy that it borrowed. So any particle is really in this combined state. This is how we think about a quantum particle. Once you say that, things get a lot more interesting when you think about two particles at once. This electron borrowed some energy to produce a photon, but it just gave that energy back and went right back to its original path. When I have two particles, say an electron and a proton, some of the time the electron borrows energy, produces a photon, absorbs it right back. The proton's doing the same thing. Some of the time, the electron borrows some energy, produces a photon, and gives that photon to the proton. The proton absorbs it instead of the electron. Now what that means, the quantum bank is happy again. It got its energy back. But the proton and the electron have each changed their energy. It's only the total energy that's conserved here. And so this is a quantum particle physicist's view of what's really happening when an electron scatters off of a proton. Now this rule, the amount of time that you're allowed to borrow that energy for being inverse to the energy, that still applies. And so that tells you that if you're exchanging an energy E, then it can only travel a distance that goes like h, this constant, times c, speed of light, divided by the energy. And this was Feynman's picture. And these photons, the ones that you need to borrow energy for and get reabsorbed by somebody else, these are usually called virtual photons. And this is one way of understanding an electric force. This, not just this one diagram where an electron emits one photon, but cases where they're all emitting, you know, thousands of photons. Some get put out by the electron, absorbed by the proton, others the other way around. The sum of all of those gives you an electric force. Now, okay, that's a bit funny because we already know a lot about electric forces, right? We have Maxwell's equations, and there the picture is very different. That a proton has an electric field, Coulomb's law, right? There's an electric field around the proton. There's a magnetic field if the proton's moving. And the electron just sees that field and bends in it Because there's a field, there's action at a distance, some force between them. Now, I should add that this concept of fields was actually really controversial, really troubled physicists at the time that Faraday started producing it, started suggesting it, Maxwell made it mathematical. Everybody was very unhappy with this picture of a field transmitting information from one place to another. What does it live in? And to some extent, and I mean, people thought, okay, it must live in the ether. We all know how that worked out. Doesn't live in the ether. They didn't find an ether. Really, what it lives in is this fact of quantum particles. Okay, that's one way of understanding where the field comes from without action at a distance. Everything can actually be happening simultaneously in one place, but these quantum particles are transmitting it, transmitting the information from one place to another. And in fact, if you just sit down as a theorist, you say, I really want, you know, Maxwell's equations work. They have electromagnetic fields. Those we know about on the tabletop. They have electromagnetic waves. Those are light. If I want to reconcile that with quantum mechanics, put them together and make a quantum theory of Maxwell's equations, I'm forced to introduce particles. And these particles that I'm forced to introduce are the smallest wave, the smallest particle of light that you can transmit. Or the other way around. If I write down a theory of particles, got quantum mechanics, and a sense of local interactions, that a particle over here, you know, even though the particles have spread out wave functions, every point in the wave function only knows what's happening at that point in space. Well, that forces me to introduce the notion of fields. So these are very, this notion of particles, the notion of fields, are very, very closely related. In this picture of particles, or quantum fields, the classical field can be thought of as a result of exchanging many, many photons between the two. And these are different ways of describing the same physics. But if you try to make either one fully consistent with quantum physics, you'll get that the theory of particles has fields in it, and the theory of fields has particles in it. Which one you want to choose as your primal building block, well, that's a matter of perspective. So when the equations on your ISSYP t-shirts, those really have fields in them. But deep down, you can think of those fields as built out of particles. This picture of Feynman's, of particles shooting out other particles and then reabsorbing them, this is actually really useful to understand why the weak interactions are weak. So electromagnetism, you can think of that as the exchange of photons. Photons don't have any mass, which means, since E equals mc squared, that the lowest energy is, well, mc squared plus a momentum piece. The lowest energy that a photon can have is zero. You can get as close to zero as you want and still produce a photon. The weak force is the exchange of massive particles, called the W and the Z. The W's have electric charge, the Z's don't. Get to the W's in a minute. For now, let's just talk about the Z's. They're heavy. They're about 100 times the mass of the proton. And so that means that the distance scale over which that the smallest energy they can have is proportional to the mass of the Z times C squared. And that means that the longest time that you can borrow energy to produce one is 1 over mz. That's a very, very short time. Sorry, I got that backwards on the slide. They exist for a very short time, so they don't travel very far. And so if you've got a neutrino, you know, if you had a proton here, it could produce photons that go a very long distance. The neutrino can just produce these Zs that go a very, very short distance, which means that some other particle over here won't even know it's there, won't be able to scatter off of it. Just like you see here, the proton's sending out tons of photons, but the neutrino doesn't have electric charge. It doesn't see those photons, and it doesn't see the Zs because it's too far away. It's only when they get really close, when the distance is small compared to this h over mz times c squared, okay, times c, because I'm talking about a distance, not a time. That's what we call the Compton wavelength of the Z boson. It's only when they get that close that the neutrino and the proton could interact. And this distance that you'd have to go to is about a hundredth the size of a proton. Very, very tiny, 10 to the minus 18 meters. Once you get to those small distances, the weak force isn't weak at all. It's actually 5 times stronger than electromagnetic forces. It's a pretty strong force, but only once things get close enough together that the mass of the Z particle doesn't stop them from interacting. It's the fact that the particles have to get so close together that makes the weak interactions weak. And that's why the detectors at Snow Lab in Japan for neutrino experiments have to be so ridiculously big, right? I mean, they were enormous. You didn't get this cool on-the-floor view because the cavern was filled with water, I think, when you were at Snow Lab. But they have to be big to make up for the very small probability that a neutrino passing through atoms, which, as you know, are mostly empty space, that that neutrino would get close enough to the proton to interact. This is also why we need, in a way, why we need accelerators. Because to really understand the weak interactions, you don't just want to know how they interact with neutrinos. That's easy, because neutrinos don't do anything else. So even if it's rare, you know, you shoot a bunch of neutrinos, and all you're going to see is weak interactions. But to really understand the weak interactions, or to look for other new interactions, you've got to look at how ordinary matter, electrons, protons, do they have weak interactions? And in order to do that, well, you have to look at really short distances where they're comparable to electric forces. You look at short distances, long distances, you just don't see them. And again, thanks to this uncertainty relation, the only way to get to really short distances is by having really big uncertainties. Sorry, really big momenta. And really big momenta exchanged in some collision. So this is why we need accelerators, to get really high momentum fundamental particles that have small position uncertainty so that we can actually see things like the weak interactions at very short distances. So particles, they're not just stuff like specks of dust. They're really the building blocks of the theory that describes everything we've seen, the matter, the forces, etc. All of these now understood things and many mysteries seem to be described by a world of quantum particles. And like I just explained with the weak forces, the mass of a particle tells you how far away its force can be felt. The familiar forces are the ones from massless particles. Because they're massless, the force is felt over long distances, like the size of a person, the size of a planet, and we can feel them. And the heavier particles, they mediate short-range forces that are very unfamiliar to the everyday world because we're a lot bigger than the distance over which they act. And so those we can only study with high energy accelerators. Now, I want to turn now to how accelerators actually work. And the first particle accelerators are really built before people knew that the world was made out of particles, before we even knew for sure that it was made out of atoms. But unbeknownst to him, Faraday, who was trying to study how electricity passes through gases, was really making a crude version of the first particle accelerator. So all he did was apply an electric potential between one side of this tube filled with very little gas and the other one. And as he made that potential big, there was a little line of glow that started showing up inside the tube. Now people over the next 30 years started developing much better vacuums. When they started developing better vacuums, this glow disappeared. But instead what they started seeing was some stuff that was hitting the end of the tube. Very end. Okay, so these tubes, what were they? Well, it was J.J. Thomson, I'm sure you've heard of him, who figured out that these things going through the tubes were actually particles that were being, charged particles that were being accelerated by that electric potential. The way he figured that out, you see here, these are little plates. So he was applying another electric potential here to see what it did. And he also put the whole thing in a magnet, see what that did to this beam, this glow that was projected onto the side of his tube. And what he realized with these was that these were actually particles that were being accelerated by the electric field, pulled out of the atom and accelerated to the other side of the tube, and then hitting it. That was what the glow was coming from. And these are what we now call electrons. Okay, so what were the technology of this first particle accelerator? There were really two technologies. I mean, there were two basic There was the vacuum, there was the electric batteries, all that stuff. But there were two basic ingredients that made it work. An electric force that accelerated the particles, right? Electrons moved towards a positive electric potential. And then a magnetic force that bends the particles. And the higher the momentum of the particles, the smaller their bend. The bend goes like one over the momentum. Pulls them into circles, doesn't push them forward, doesn't change their speed. And the direction's opposite if the charge is reversed. Those two basic ingredients are also the key to how the LHC does its thing, both the acceleration and the measurement of the particles, largely coming from these two ingredients. Now, these ingredients, specifically the fact that the direction of the magnetic bending depends on charge, were also key to the first discovery of antimatter, right around the same time that the neutron was being discovered. Carl Anderson also saw the first evidence for a particle that behaved just like the electron, except that it bent the other direction in a magnetic field. So, must have the opposite charge. This was actually very fortuitous for Paul Dirac, who had been very embarrassed that his new relativistic theory of electrons predicted a new particle. That was like the greatest shame, because clearly there were no new particles in the world, or so was the prevailing thought. But, you know, fortunately, it turned out his new particle that he had predicted was actually there, called the positron. And so this is an antiparticle, and it turns out that in Dirac's theory, in any relativistic theory of particles, you really can't avoid having antiparticles. Whatever particles there are in the theory, they have to have. If they're charged, they have to have a corresponding antiparticle. And the implications of that are huge, because conservation of charge is really the only thing we have to explain why certain things don't happen. Why is the electron stable? It's stable because it has an electric charge. What could it decay to? And that conservation law is what forbids, you know, total anarchy of the universe. But now, if you have an antiparticle, you can, if you have enough energy at least, you can create electrons, you know, to your heart's delight. So if you have enough energy, E equals mc squared, and all of a sudden you can create an electron and a positron out of any kind of collision. Or you can annihilate an electron off a positron and just get light. There is a way to respect all the conservation of charge in the world and still create and destroy particles. And a simple example of that, well, I don't know how simple, but one of the first important ones is if you go back to this old story of an electron scattering off of a proton. So here, if you think about an electron that gets really close to the proton, you know, just classically, you know that the electron has an electric potential energy that depends on the product of their charges and how far away they are. So if they get really, really close, and it goes like 1 over radius. So as they get closer, radius gets small, that potential energy gets really big. And as that potential energy gets big, we know by E equals mc squared that quantum mechanics can produce particles, can produce new particles whose energy, whose mass is equal to that energy that's achieved. So once they get close, it's guaranteed that quantum mechanics will produce some of these particles. And this is what I was saying earlier. Every reaction that we have, every reaction you can imagine that conserves energy, momentum, and charge, and a few other things, does happen in the universe. It'll happen some fraction of the time, not always, but it's guaranteed that if there's no symmetry forbidding it, then it's going to happen, because the interactions of the theory will allow it. It's really this process, production of particles by turning energy into mass, that has helped us understand the other forces, these more mysterious forces, the strong and the weak. It's not just watching how electrons scatter at really short distances. It's also actually producing new particles. So because these strong and weak interactions, they're pretty mysterious to us. We read about them in textbooks, and it's like, what? The strong holds the proton together? OK. So I want to try to explain how we've learned about these forces in a nutshell. So what's the strong force? Well, imagine you had a new kind of electromagnetic force, just like it, but with a different charge. And actually, this has a more intricate system of charges. Okay, so it turns out that there's instead of just one plus and one minus charge, there's three different types of plus charge. Okay, red, green, blue. And if you put all three of them together, that's attractive. So that means that you get triples of quarks, one with the red charge, one with the blue, one with the green. Put them together, that's an attractive force. There's one more thing that makes this strong force really special, which is that as you pull a particle farther and farther apart, normally, if you look at an electromagnetic force, right, and I have particle A plus B minus, and I separate them, as a function of the distance between A and B, the potential energy, if it's attractive, it'll go something like this, right? It gets very attractive at short distances, but it goes like 1 over radius. So the further apart you are, the less energy cost there is. Like, there's a lot less energy cost in separating A is here, in separating B from here to here. That's a lot easier than separating B from here to here. It takes a lot less energy difference, right? This strong force has a very different behavior. And at first, the potential energy looks like that, but then it just keeps going up, up and up and up. So once you get out of this really high energy region, it's basically the same. No matter how far away you are, it still takes a lot of energy to get further and further apart. With any finite amount of energy compared to your starting point, you'll only get a finite distance away. You'll never get all the way out. So there's no such thing as an unbound, a free quark, the way there's a free electron. Okay, so what happens? Let's say you do have some energy. This is one of the things, you know, so quarks are like, they're, you know, it's very, so you can pull quarks away out of a proton. It's not that they're forever locked into the proton itself. You can pull it away, but it takes energy. As you pull it further and further, you're putting more and more energy into the system. And as I mentioned, once you have enough energy, you can always create new particles out of it. So this is what happens. And eventually, the energy becomes big enough that energy stored here in the strong force field between these guys is big enough that it can just turn into new particles. Can turn into, say, an up quark and an anti-up quark. And then these are attractive, and this is attractive again. This guy will collapse back in, lose its energy, turn into an ordinary proton. This is something called a pi meson. Both are stable objects. So the strong force is very efficient at turning energy into a huge number of particles. Because the more energy you put in, this will just keep happening and happening and happening, and creating more and more little pairs. And each time you do, you've created a new stable particle too. That's why most of the images you see from the LHC, at least the ones that haven't been cleaned up, are such a complete mess, right? I mean, all this yellow stuff in the center, that's actually the least interesting part of the collision, even though it looks like there's a lot going on. That is nothing but the tracks produced by this process when one proton hits another. And in fact, the LHC collides particles together so efficiently that multiple protons, every time they hit, multiple protons, something like 10 or 20 pairs, do this kind of thing. Okay? But we just don't care about it for most purposes. For most purposes, what we're really interested in is the stuff. And you can tell, by the way, remember that all of this stuff is inside of a magnetic field. The more a track bends in the magnetic field, the lower its momentum, right? So you can tell just by looking at it that these guys are fairly low energy stuff, because they're bending around a lot. Okay, and then the weak force, I shouldn't spend too much time on this so that there's time for questions at the end. We already met the Z particle. There's also the charged W particle This guy is itself electrically charged, so you better not, if you're going to conserve charge, a neutron can't emit a W particle and stay a neutron. What it can do is emit a W particle and turn into a proton. So the force that the W mediates is actually a force that turns one kind of particle into another. Now, this is pretty weird, but if the W weren't heavy, so I said the W and the Z are both really heavy, like 100 times heavier than the proton. If the W weren't heavy, then this kind of thing would be happening all the time, as often as electric interactions. So we wouldn't even say that protons and neutrons are different kinds of particles, that neutrinos and electrons are different kinds of particles. We would just say that they were different charges of the same particle. And because there'd be no way of telling whether you had a neutrino or an electron, because it would be constantly changing back and forth. So that's how important it is that these particles have a big mass, the W and the Z. That if the W didn't have mass, then this picture of what the particles really are, in terms of how we big people see them, would be totally different. Okay, and because it can change particles from one type to another, if you just twist the legs around on that diagram that I drew earlier, bring the neutrino coming in, turn that into an antineutrino going out, you get another diagram that can happen, where the neutron actually decays into a proton, electron, and antineutrino. And this was the first hint, radioactive beta decay. This was the first hint that there were weak interactions at all. It's a very rare process because the W mass is heavy, which means that all of this stuff, all of this changing around has to happen in a really small size again. And the wave functions of all these particles that are involved, the neutron, the proton, electron, and antineutrino, theirs are much bigger. So it's that difference of sizes that makes this process of radioactive decay slow, that makes nuclei almost stable. So all of these, even the unfamiliar ones, the up quark, the down quark, electron, neutrino, they're antiparticles, and these four forces, they're very much a part of our daily life. So much so, in fact, that you need all of those forces, and gravity, obviously, in order to understand how the sun shines. So how does the sun shine? Our favorite, like, eight-year-old question. Well, you know, it's not a very good answer to give an eight-year-old, but the way the sun shines is that the sun is full of atoms, and in those atoms are protons. The protons have equal electric charges, so they repel one another. But there's also the strong force that at very short distances actually pulls them together. Turns out it doesn't pull them together enough to compensate for this repulsion. So this doesn't really happen. And if you just had these two forces, you just have a sort of, you know, boring equilibrium of atoms sitting around close to each other. But then there's the weak force. The weak force can actually transmute this. It's the opposite of the reaction I just showed you, where the proton can turn into a neutron, and in the process, emit a positron and a neutrino. Now, the neutrino flies off. Nobody except Snow Lab can see it. That doesn't make the sun shine. But that electron, that positron, will hit somebody else in the center of the sun, hit some electron, annihilate into high-energy light, and then that gradually sifts through the rest of the sun, turns into lower and lower energy photons, and that is how the sun shines. Now, so it's all three of these forces working together, gravity holding the whole thing together, that we need to understand the sun. And this can actually be done really precisely. So one of the things that Snow Lab and other neutrino experiments have done is, see, these positrons, they get turned into eventually visible light, but they scatter off a bunch of other atoms in the process inside the sun. You don't really see what energy of positron was produced. But these neutrinos are really nice, precisely because they don't interact. If you do manage to see the neutrinos, you're getting at what the primal energy was involved in that transition from two protons into a proton and a neutron, and all the other processes that are happening in the sun. So these experiments can actually measure the neutrino energies and test how often a neutrino comes in with each energy and test very precisely this picture of bigger and bigger nuclei being formed. And that's how we know that this theory really works to very good precision. So All of that, a lot of little random facts about the forces of nature, but the one point that I want you to take away above all others is that particles are special in this other way. Not only are they responsible for forces, but they can be created and destroyed. They're not immutable at all. Every charged particle has an antiparticle, and so that means you can always create particles if you have enough energy. And that's another reason to go to accelerators, because if you want to hunt for new forces and new patterns in nature, you need to find the particles. And the way to find those particles, in many cases, is by just getting enough energy together that you can produce them. So this was the first modern particle accelerator, I guess, the cyclotron, used to really reach energies comparable to the mass of a proton, start producing new particles. And a few more recent ones, as you see, getting larger. This is the Tevatron near Chicago, just the second highest energy collider, second to last particle discovery, fundamental particle discovery in the world, that of the top quark, built in the 1980s. Now I want to move on to the Large Hadron Collider. So I'll fly over to Geneva. And this is the 26-kilometer wide ring of the LHC. What's happening all over here? Well, this is the French-Swiss border. The protons in the ring don't really care. Actually, the customs agents don't either. But and here you can see inside of the tunnel. People don't ride in it while it's operating, but while they were testing things out, people use these little tunnel buggy cycles to go through. This is one of the magnets disconnected. And you can see here lots of electrical connections. And actually, just these two little pipes in the center, that's where the particles go through. That's where the protons go through as they're accelerated. And they take this very long path. They start out at pretty low energies. They go through this booster accelerator. Then they go through this one called the proton synchrotron. Each one, they go around and around and around with the magnetic field keeping them in the circle as they get boosted to higher and higher energies. And then they move on to the next guy, which can reach even higher energies. So SPS gets them to, I think, about 400 gigaelectron volts. LHC gets them to right now to 4,000 gigaelectron volts. That's the final stage of the acceleration. All the acceleration, remember those magnets, they don't change the speed or the energy of a particle. So they have nothing at all to do with getting them up to their energy directly. All of that actually happens just in a little corner around here, a little corner of the accelerator, in these accelerating cavities. And these basically work exactly the same way as the cathode ray tube, the thing that Thomson used to discover the electron. It's quite a bit more complicated. They use radio frequency alternating electric fields. But the idea is the same, that as a proton goes through, it's going to get pulled towards negative electric fields. And so they make sure that the proton's going through one way and the proton's going through the other way both accelerate a little on this. And I think it's several thousand times through that a proton has to go before it gets accelerated to the full energy of the LHC. So how are you going to keep it going around thousands of times? Well, you've got to use a magnetic field to bend the protons, right? And that's what these magnets are for. These are the highest energy proton beams in the world by a factor of 4. And if they get up to their design energies by a factor, they'll be at the highest by a factor of 7. So at those energies, even though these are really the highest field magnets that one can make reliably in the world, they only bend the protons over this like 10-meter length of the magnet by 7 centimeters. So if you just picture that, and it's funny, when you go into the tunnels there, even though you know from all those pictures that it's a circle, when you go into the tunnels, well, like you can kind of see here, you can just, they look straight. They're not bending very much over that distance. They actually, each magnet has a tiny bend to it to keep the protons aligned with the center. But it's not at all visible to the naked eye because it's just 7 centimeters over that huge distance. So in a sense, the LHC is a really small, efficient, compact machine. It's as small as it could be and still get, with modern magnet technology, still get the protons to close the circle. Okay, now most of the time, the protons just scurry around, get accelerated, go back through, don't talk to each other very much. There's just these 4 points here where they align the magnets such that the two beams collide. And what I'll focus on are the two experiments that do the high-energy proton-proton collisions. These other ones, well, one of them is also high-energy, but it's mainly looking at other physics. The other one is mostly looking at heavy ion physics, where they collide lead nuclei against each other, gold nuclei. This one and this one, these are where, for example, the data leading to the Higgs discovery were collected. So at each one of those, you get one of these enormous detectors. And I don't know if any of you had a chance to go to CERN and actually look at these things before they closed the caps. If you had, it is just amazing. I mean, you're standing in this hall dwarfed by this enormous piece of equipment. There's like 3 or 4 flights of stairs just to get to where the protons go through from the floor. And they just go in this little tiny pipe that size, and around them, this 80-meter hunk of metal, or in the case of Atlas, mostly air. So what's going on in all that hunk of metal and other stuff? Well, actually, most of it is a lot more complicated than just a block of metal. It's made up of a bunch of different layers. You can kind of see this here, these alternating red. That's one type of layer. This is another. The others are all too deep inside for us to see. But here's a picture of one of them. One of the innermost layers is actually built out of strips of silicon. Strips of very well instrumented silicon. And what that lets them do is every time a charged particle goes through the silicon, it leaves a little electrical signal and that tells you very precisely where the charged particle hit the silicon. And then basically they connect the dots. So there's highly sophisticated connect the dot computer algorithms that figure out which dots have to do with the same particle and trace where it was moving. And then you use the bend inside of magnetic field to figure out how fast the particle was moving. And voila, you know what charged particles you produced. And then these other detectors help in figuring out which particles are which, and also learning something about the neutral particles, the ones that aren't bending. Say you have a photon that you produce. Well, it's not charged. It's not going to bend in the magnetic field at all. But it'll leave lots of energy in this second layer. And that's how you know it's a photon. You know where it came from and how much energy it had. And this, here you can see the construction of the outer layers and also the big magnet for Atlas. Again, even more magnificently huge detector. All of the space inside of these big coils has been filled in since by detector parts. Now, most of the particles we want to study, let's say you want to study a Z boson or a W boson, these particles that lead to the weak force, most of them decay almost instantly. So the detectors, they decay into electrons and positrons or into electrons and neutrinos or whatever, a bunch of quarks. The detectors have to take pictures of those products of the decay and then piece back together what happened. So here's a case where two of the particles called muons were produced. Okay, and they could tell they're muons. Muons are just like electrons, but basically a heavier cousin of the electron, but otherwise same charge, et cetera, that make it all the way out to the last layer of the detector. That's how they know they're muons. And then they put together the momenta and the energies of those two muons to figure out, by conservation of momentum, conservation of energy, what mass of particle could have produced them. It's probably, the mass lines up so that this was probably a decaying Z particle. But we can never know for sure, because all we see are the two muons. Maybe something else happened that just happened to line up with the mass of a Z particle. Because everything that's allowed to happen by the theory will happen some of the time. And it's quantum, so we can't predict when. We can't predict when a collision will produce a Z. We can't predict how it'll decay once it's produced. Only the probabilities of each type of decay. And then comparing it to the fraction of events where that actually happens. All right. So as of July 3rd, 2012, we, the general public, had seen directly or indirectly, mostly indirectly, evidence for these particles. And on July 4th, 4th, in North America and Europe, the Higgs. Evidence for the Higgs was presented. So what is this guy? Why do we care so much about the Higgs particle? Why did we actually? This is really an incredible story because the Higgs particle was predicted 60 years ago as a theoretical construct. And as time went on, by the 70s, people had really good theoretical reasons to think that something like the Higgs had to exist. And that's what I'll explain to you now. But it took all this time, 40 years, to get from there to actually seeing it and realizing and confirming that these theories were true. So why does one, based on what we know as of July 3rd, all of these particles, why was everyone so sure that there should be something like a Higgs particle? Well, basically, it came from thought experiments. So people, if you imagine the thought experiment, just like, I mean, Einstein figured out a lot of special and general relativity by doing thought experiments about people moving on really fast-moving trains and logical inconsistencies that would happen unless you added unless you had special relativity. And the Higgs was predicted in a similar way. So the thought experiment here was, if you like, W particles crashing together on trains, two really high energy W particles. What happens to them? How much do they interact with each other? As you get to higher energies, remember, you're looking at really small distances where their interaction can be quite significant. And in fact, in the standard model without a Higgs, you could calculate the probability that these two W's would somehow, you know, interact with each other's fields and scatter, and one would move off this way, one would move off the other way. That probability that you calculate in the theory starts getting bigger than one. So that means theory, your theory is clearly not working for you. Probabilities have to be smaller than one. So the theory, that was the basis for thinking this theory has to be incomplete. And in fact, if you scattered W's off of any other kind of particle at high enough energies, eventually you'd run into the same problems. Okay, but these problems have to do with the fact that the W carries has some mass. If you had massless particles like the photon, no such problem. Only when you're talking about massive particles that have a spin of one. Okay, so that's a bit technical, but the W, the photon, all of these have spin one. And and when you have particles with those specific properties that have been measured for the W's, you scatter them together at high energies, the theory gives nonsense answers. Okay, so clearly if they're scattering too much, well, they're scattering because there's some force between them. You have to add a new force that cancels it off. That's the only way to reconcile this. And a specific kind of force you have to add is a force carried by the Higgs particles, by some other massive particle of spin zero. And the funny thing about this force is that the coupling, the strength of the force for the W, has to be precisely related to the W mass in order to cancel this problematic calculation, make it work at all energies. And in fact, the coupling to the top quark has to be proportional to the top quark's mass, coupling to the electron, to the electron's mass. All the fundamental particles, not necessarily the proton, but all the fundamental particles have to have couplings proportional to their masses in order to cancel off this weird problematic term in the scattering cancellation. Now, that's a little weird, right? How should this particle know what all the masses are? And this has nothing to do with gravity. It's not, a lot of people think it does because, you know, mass, gravity, Higgs, they all sort of, you know, masses related to gravity, masses related to the Higgs. But gravity really couples to all the energy of a particle. And the Higgs doesn't. It just couples to the mass of these fundamental particles. So how do we understand why it, you know, how it knows what coupling to have, and that's precisely tuned to the mass of the particle? Well, it had better be that they're related in some fundamental way. And the way that we've understood that this could happen is that the field associated with the Higgs particle, just like electromagnetic fields are associated with particles of light, photons, that field actually does contribute. If you have that field in an area, it contributes to how massive a particle feels, to how much inertia it experiences, how much energy it takes to produce the particles, how much inertia they feel as you push them around. So all of these fundamental particle masses can receive corrections from a Higgs field, And if they came entirely from a Higgs field that fills all of space, then you would get this sort of magic property that we want, that the mass is exactly proportional to the Higgs to the Higgs coupling, right? And now this is not because the Higgs somehow knows about the mass. It's because the mass knows about the coupling to the Higgs. Mass is actually coming from the coupling to the Higgs. So that is the basic reason why we knew there must be something like a Higgs field out there, because it was the only way to make these theories consistent. Now, there were a lot of different ideas about exactly what kind of Higgs field it is, whether there's one or two different types of particles associated with it. So we didn't know exactly how it would work. But it was clear that very important aspects of the world, the fact that the W and Z are heavy, I mentioned if they were massless, you know, protons and neutrons would look like the same particle, and radioactive decays would be a lot faster. The electron would have no mass, so you couldn't have atoms. The electrons would just fly freely at the speed of light in space all the time. So all of these very, you know, mundane but very key critical things about the universe, ultimately we understand is coming from the Higgs particle. And so trying to understand how this particle behaves is clearly pretty important. And the key to looking for it is really this basic fact that I posited in order to make the whole story work, that the fundamental particles have an interaction with the Higgs, have a charge for the Higgs, if you will, that's proportional to their masses. Okay, but this is also kind of a sad story to tell, because, well, what are the particles with the fundamental particles with the biggest masses? The top quark, the W and the Z particles, and these decay really way too fast in the blink of an eye to even, well, technically much, much less than the blink of an eye. Way too fast to build an accelerator that collides them. So what do you do? Well, the particles we can actually work with, these guys in the lower row, the things that make up ordinary stuff, the gluon that's involved in the proton, these all have no mass. They have very little or very tiny masses. They have very little coupling to the Higgs. The charge of the up and down quark is about 0.00003. That's puny. So how do we, so this is why this particle was so hard to find, because the stuff that we can work with is the lightest stuff, has very small couplings to the Higgs. Stuff with big couplings, because it's so heavy, it decays really fast. So how do we do it? Well, life would be grand, as I just said, if we had a top anti-top collider. The coupling to the Higgs is big. This would just produce Higgses all the time. We don't have a top collider, but we have quantum mechanics, which is like a quantum. So the LHC is really a quantum top collider in addition to other things. So the LHC can produce top and anti-top quarks. Those decay quickly. It can also produce what I mentioned earlier, these virtual quarks, ones with not quite much energy, where you have to borrow some energy from the quantum bank in order to produce them. And they live for a little bit of time. Then they've got to come back together, give their energy back. When they do that, they can produce a Higgs particle. So this is not a very efficient process. It's actually pretty rare, very rare, for gluons for inside the protons of the LHC to do this. But they can some of the time. Just to give you an idea, that's actually the main process that produces Higgses. And whereas the LHC produces W particles 150 times a second and tops every 2 seconds, it produces a Higgs just at a rate of 5 a minute. Now, that still seems like a lot of Higgs particles, right? Thing's been running for 2 years. So why wasn't it just a matter of a few minutes to see it? Well, two reasons. The first one is that the ways that the Higgs decays that we can actually really single out, really understand and measure precisely are pretty rare. So there's another quantum process, I know this is hard to see, where the Higgs, through another one of these quantum production absorption things, it can decay into two photons. This is only like a 1 in 1,000 decay mode for the Higgs. So it's pretty rare. Out of those every 5 a minute that it produces, most of them don't do this. They go into completely unmeasurable modes, but sometimes they can decay into photons. These we can see very cleanly in the detector. Sometimes it'll decay into Z particles, And those in turn decay into, say, electrons or muons. I didn't draw the muons, just the electrons. Those are also very easy to see in the detector. But remember, we don't get to see what happened in the middle. All we get to see are the final particles that came out. And photons and electrons are a dime a dozen at the LHC. So we're only seeing these end products. How are you going to figure out that they're from a Higgs? The only thing that sets the Higgs apart from everything else is its mass. That the photons from some other random process, some of them will have one mass, some of them will have another mass. But when they're coming from a Higgs, they should all reconstruct the mass of the Higgs. Now, what do I mean? I'm not talking about the masses of an individual photon. Photons have zero mass. But you can measure their energy. You can measure their direction. You know they have zero mass, so you can predict. You can calculate what their momentum was. And then use conservation of energy and momentum to figure out what mass of Higgs they could have come from. So that's what I mean. If these two photons came from a single particle, what mass would that particle have had to have in order to give you the energy and the momentum of those photons? That, for any pair of photons you see at the LHC, that's a number that you can just calculate from the data. Then you make a histogram, stack all the events on top of each other, and with a few lines to guide the eye and a lot of details that I've left out about exactly how you select the best measured photons in the detector, this is what you get. So this green part is a smooth curve coming from everything else that's not the Higgs. And for a variety of reasons, the higher the mass, the more rare the processes are, basically because it takes a lot of energy being concentrated to get to those high masses. But here you see a bump. This bump is the thing that basically seems to be evidence for a Higgs. So this is about a year's worth of these two photon events collected together, and then you see evidence that actually there's one mass that's preferred. So this is the evidence for a new particle. Now, before you call it a Higgs, you want to see that it does all the other things a Higgs should do. And checking all of the things that a Higgs should do is very hard, because many of them have, you know, this red bump, okay, at least it's a factor, it's like only a tenth the size of the background. There's other cases where it's like a thousandth the size of the background. So, you know, it's really tough there to measure, even though those are some of the strongest couplings of the Higgs, just because it's the particles that are produced, the particles produced in those decays are much more common at the LHC than the two photons. But there's a few other things one can check, and one of them is the other decay I mentioned into four electrons or muons. And again, those also show there's a lot fewer of them, but there's very little of the other processes. So here's a case where they're all just coming from a single Z. That lines up right at the mass of the Z. That's a very big peak. Case where all four of them are coming from a Higgs, that's a fair bit smaller, a factor of two or three smaller, but you can still see a clustering of points. And roughly the size of that signal over the smooth background is compatible with what you'd expect if it were a Higgs particle. So this is a big success. As I mentioned, this is a particle that was just predicted based on thought experiments, the consistency of the theory. It matches all the predictions so far for what a Higgs would be. But one of the most interesting things would be if they keep measuring it, the uncertainties in exactly how often those different kinds of processes are happening, if the rates of all these different processes can be measured much more precisely, and they disagree a little with the standard model, then we know that there was actually something, you know, only half right about the theory. We got the particle right, but not the details, and that's something else to understand. All right, so why? What else are we looking for? Let's see. All right, this is roughly a map of some of the scales in the universe. Not all of them, actually. This figure should go all the way to somewhere on that left blackboard. What I'm doing here is every step, every tick mark represents a power of 10 higher energies moving to the right and shorter distances moving to the right or longer distances moving to the left. So the Earth is about one, two, three, four, five, six, seven lines to the left of a person because the Earth is 10 million times, 10 to the 7 times bigger than a person. And then you move down to smaller sizes, you get to the size of an atom, size of a proton, and now at this point it makes a lot more sense to start talking about the energies of things than the sizes of things. So the energy, the mass of a proton, is about 100 times less than the mass of a W particle. This is all the maximum we've really explored directly, is right around here. But there seems to be a much bigger energy scale in the world, in the universe. That's the scale where gravity is becoming a sort of a strong force, the scale where the gravitational attraction of, say, two protons or two electrons becomes significant. That only happens when they're at very high energies, or alternately when they're at very short distances to each other. This is where their gravitational energy becomes important. And if you were to take two electrons, you know, they're just free electrons, not with a bunch of, you know, not with a laptop attached to them, the gravity they would feel is many, many billions of times weaker than the electric force that they would feel. So there's this big gap. We think our theories can probably make sense all the way up to this energy, the strong gravity energy, but we haven't tested it. Okay, so what happens if the standard model, what's happening in here? This is obviously a big enough range. We want to understand everything that's going on there. We have to use theory to help us because there's no way we're going to build a 100 quadrillion times bigger LHC. And it's already 26 kilometers. So how do we think about this? Well, we just think about it. That's the only option. And one of the things that we think about is making sense of a quantum theory with all the particles we know, plus some new stuff at this scale, the scale where gravity becomes strong. Presumably, there's a lot going on there. Maybe string theory. Who knows? Well, quantum mechanics, from all that stuff going on at really high masses, that's going to actually affect what we think the W mass is. So we measure the W mass. We know what it is. It's 80-some gigaelectron volts. But if you were to try to calculate it in the theory, you'd say, well, it has two parts. It has a classical part. That's just an input to the theory. You know, when you write down the theory, you put in the classical mass of the W. Then there's a quantum part. That comes from summing a bunch of Feynman diagrams and calculating how these quantum processes change the energy of a W particle. That quantum part of the calculus, that's a calculation. It's not an input. And what you get is some number times the largest mass in the theory. So if that largest mass was this strong gravity scale, you'd have kind of a big problem. Because now that means that in units where one is about the W mass, so hundreds of gigaelectron volts, the classical part, the quantum part, is some big number, you know, 120, whatever, of order 100 quadrillion. The classical part had better be, in that theory, almost exactly the same number with the other sign, so that when you sum them up, you get a number that's close to one in units of hundreds of gigaelectron volts. Now, this is really troubling to us because, I mean, how implausible is that? That really, in any sensible theory, the W mass would have been the same as this scale of strong gravity within a factor of 10 or so. It's only because of this incredibly intricate cancellation that we see the world as it is. That just seems crazy. Okay, so we have to go back to the drawing board of this theory. Does it really make sense that the theory would go up all the way to this high energy? Or is our theory of particles, as we understand it, only valid up to someplace near here? So this is M largest, and it's only of order 10. We don't need a very big cancellation anymore. That would be a much more palatable theory. But then something really dramatic has to happen here, so that we can still have a theory that's compatible with there being something going on at really high energies. But the Higgs and the W mass, those somehow don't know about it. Okay, so there's much of the physics that's called beyond the standard model particle physics. It's about trying to resolve this conundrum. We need some new phenomenon that saves the day at an energy close to what we've starting. And sorry that got cut off. So there's two options for what happens above this scale. Two very basic options. Maybe I should say three. One is that the W particle and the Higgs particle, they're really like the proton, they're made up of other particles. Okay, and so once you start talking about this strong gravity scale correcting people's masses, it's not correcting the W's masses, it's creating other guys' masses. And the mass of the W is set by some other mechanism. Now that would have been fine if the Higgs mass, a very good theory, had measurements in the past turned out differently. Had the Higgs mass been measured to be 300 GeV, many times heavier than the W, that would be an indication that the Higgs is actually a strongly interacting particle. Not the same strong force, but a different force that is also strong, just like the proton. The proton has big interactions. But the Higgs isn't at 300 gigaelectron volts. It's actually pretty close to the W mass. The other option is that there's some new symmetry in the world that's only approximate. So just like we have conserved charge, there's something else. Maybe, you know, supersymmetry is one option that's been tossed around a lot, although there's still no observational evidence for anything like it. This is the possibility that actually that number, for some very special reasons about the theory, that number turns out to be close to zero. Okay, so then M quantum doesn't need all of those digits are automatically zero down to the near the very end, and then you don't need a dramatic cancellation anymore. Third possibility is that actually we're wrong that this is the energy scale where gravity comes from. Gravity really comes from an energy close to us. There's no theory above maybe, you know, 10, 100 times bigger energies than the LHC explored. But actually, once you get above those energies, you know, asking questions about particles and their energies doesn't even make sense anymore. And in that case, the question is, well, why does gravity appear to be so weak compared to what you would have expected? Because you would have expected gravity to get strong. And, you know, how do you incorporate such a weak force in a theory that doesn't go up to this energy? So those are sort of three ways of resolving this puzzle. All of them imply new particles right above our head, new particles showing something dramatic is happening at the Large Hadron Collider somewhere around here. So a lot of the work that people do is looking for that. And another thing is looking for dark matter. So I'm sure that Cliff has mentioned this in his cosmology talk. I don't want to spend too much time on it. I want to get to questions. But dark matter seems to be built out of particles. Those particles could be produced at the LHC. If you want to talk later about how one would actually see them, because they're dark, they don't interact with the detector, we can do that, but I'll leave it for now. So the rules that work at the LHC, the reason we're so intent on studying particles, is because these rules that lead to the production of those particles are the same ones that govern how a star burns, govern what makes a galaxy collect into itself as strongly as it does, how, you know, we hit the what happens when we hit the table, what's happening with radioactive decays inside our bodies. In order to understand that at a deeper level and going down to the smallest distance scales, we have to do these experiments. I don't know what to expect. We all have guesses, but the whole point is that we don't know, that we need to do these experiments in order to find out. And I'll just remind you of going back to this first particle accelerator, that often studying the things we don't understand has broadened our understanding in many more ways than we had expected. Faraday didn't know he was building a particle accelerator just studying electricity through gases. So we'll see. Stay tuned. There should be a lot of interesting results ahead at the LHC. Thanks.